From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a new film looks at the influence of dark money on politics in Montana, Wisconsin, and across the country.
Then, as Milwaukee Opera Theater opens its newest production tonight, artistic director Jill Anaponicek reflects on the company's creative process.
It's in selecting the risk that you're taking with a particular production and knowing that you don't know how that will turn out. And so you are genuinely risking failure.
Wauwatosa writer Tom Matthews explains how a dream about his deceased father inspired him to write his novel, Raising the Dead.
It just really affected me, just to be in the same room with him and touch his warm skin and know you're breathing the same air. It really, really, in a way, no other dream ever has really stuck with me.
And Bubbler Talk looks at the current state of a former Milwaukee shopping mall. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. This past week, President Trump's former lawyer Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to a multitude of charges, including falsifying submissions to a bank and campaign finance violations. Campaign finance regulations are considered by many to be among the most pressing issues affecting American democracy, but it can be hard for the average citizen to understand them.
A new documentary seeks to change that. Dark Money is about just that, money spent on political campaigns with roots that are sometimes impossible to trace. The film follows John Adams, a Montana journalist and Wisconsin native, in his efforts to expose the effects of the Supreme Court ruling Citizens United and its connections to dark money groups involved in local and federal elections there. Montana has had a push-pull between outside corporate interests and internal politics for more than a century.
Here in Wisconsin, potential campaign finance violations were at the heart of the so-called John Doe 2 case involving Governor Scott Walker's campaign and outside groups in 2011 and 2012. The film opens in Milwaukee today. Dark Money director and producer Kimberly Reed joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to discuss the greater implications of campaign finance issues, from rules to reforms to dark money's expanding reach.
You know, these days it's not just political campaigns. We're seeing it just with pushing issues. We're seeing it with pushing judicial nominations. That's something we're seeing at the federal level now. The technique is usually by hiding money coming through a social welfare nonprofit group. There are 501c4 groups that were designed to do things like a neighborhood association that cleans up the park. That's actually what I belong to, a 501c4 group that does that in my neighborhood. What they weren't meant to do is to hide millions of dollars that are intended to go into political campaigns or issue campaigns so that they can change people's votes.
Right. And how do you feel that the influence of dark money has changed the moderating role of political parties? Do you think it's attributed to the growth of the, you know, quote, extreme sides on the right or the left?
Absolutely. I mean, what we're seeing is systems that are actually becoming more powerful than the political parties themselves. And as you say, they do tend to moderate each other and sort of swing back and forth, especially these days. But first of all, let me, you know, dark money happens on both the left and the right. So I think we all need to watch out for it. But in the 2014 election cycle, the Koch brothers spent more money than the Republican Party. So when you have two people who are beckoning potential political candidates to, you know, their convention so that they can kiss the ring. When you have individuals, not even two brothers, individuals like Sheldon Adelson, who kind of force people to run through their own gamut to make sure that these folks are good on issues, it really distorts democracy. It takes power out of the hands of the political parties. It certainly takes power out of the hands of the everyday individuals. And it puts it into the hands of, you know, just a couple wealthy people.
How did Montana become the microcosm for the issue of dark money that drew your attention to it enough to focus Montana in a documentary?
You know, it's a bit of a complicated answer to that, which sort of takes a whole film to answer. I think it's a really interesting answer, but just in broad strokes, Montana has a really interesting history of dealing with corporate influence in politics. As a state that has a lot of natural resources and not very many people there, for its entire history, it's been subject to control from outside money that comes in, wants to develop natural resources, and then wants to leave without cleaning up after the inevitable mess that is created with a lot of that development. And by contending with that and developing, I think, a pretty strong backbone of resistance when it comes to that corporate influence over Montana's politics, you see a pretty strong grassroots pushback against that sort of spending in politics. The other side of that kind of dramatic clash that we saw happening in Montana was the fact that the same group of lawyers who were behind Citizens United started opening up shop, quite literally, in Montana so that they could test the relatively strong campaign finance laws. I think the thinking was, you know, if you could tear down the laws in Montana, you could do it anywhere. So that, you know, it became the tip of the spear for a lot of those legal battles.
You mentioned Montana has a good history of resisting corporations and big money in politics. But for those listeners out there who may not know automatically what kind of strategies and tactics that dark money and money in campaign finance may do, can you touch upon some of the strategies such as ads or things like that? And whether you think if these strategies are an abuse of free speech?
So the first thing that voters can do to keep an eye out for these tactics is to just follow the source of the funding as much as you can. Now, sometimes that's tough because they're sort of onto the game and usually name an organization something like Americans for Apple Pie who love America. You know, how could you possibly protest a group that has such lofty aims? But what you can do and what you can encourage your elected officials and, importantly, your local journalists on the ground, what you can do is go to places like followthemoney.org or opensecrets.org and track the spending of these groups to see who's really behind them. Now, the dark money dodge involves all sorts of obfuscation there. So I think that when you see an ad, probably at the last minute, it's probably really negative in tone. It's probably run by an organization with some lofty, patriotic-sounding name. You can probably bet that there's some obfuscation behind it. Sometimes there's confusion between whether an ad is coming from a super PAC or from a dark money group. These days, they're pretty much being used interchangeably. So if you want to anonymize the source of this money, you run it through a 501c4 group, whereas if you don't care about that anonymity, you run it through a super PAC. But when you bounce money back and forth between the two, it launders that money. So the most important thing that people need to do is to make sure that we have disclosure laws on the books in our localities, and that we actually enforce them and we hold our elected officials accountable. If you're a candidate and you're running for office, running on a platform that says that you're not going to take any dark money, that you're not going to take any corporate PAC money, those have been very popular positions, and they've proven to be effective, too, just as a political strategy. So at the end of the day, it does become a First Amendment discussion. It becomes a First Amendment debate about, you know, where is this level of free speech? Folks on the other side of the dark money debate will say that they think that having to disclose who's putting money into these political campaigns is a violation of their free speech rights. I would disagree with that and tend to say that with more money comes more power and more speech. That's just how it works. One of the things we saw in Montana is, like, you know, pretty quickly in a cheap state, right, where the media markets are really affordable, pretty quickly you can buy up every ad in the whole state. I mean, this really is a zero-sum game. Some people do have more speech than others, and if you get there first with more money than others, you just get more speech. And I think that the folks who are pushing for campaign finance reform on a bunch of different angles, some are advocating for, you know, constitutional amendments to overturn Citizens United. Other folks are really kind of pushing at the local level to establish free and clear and transparent elections. But all of that really comes down to a fundamental kind of re-understanding of what the First Amendment does and how it can equalize that political speech.
Well, and that kind of touches upon the long-debated questions of our corporations people, too, does it not?
Yeah, it does. And that's a whole other, you know, kind of the two arms of Citizens United are that, you know, money is speech, and corporations are people. And we've just been talking about the money of speech part. And the other important component of that is coming to an understanding of, you know, corporate personhood, which has a very long history of jurisprudence in the U.S. and is going to take a lot of unwinding. But what folks can do, especially at the municipality level, like in Milwaukee, is to make sure that elections that are run at the city level, that's a really good starting place. We're talking city councils, we're talking school boards, we're talking your mayoral race, to make sure that you can ensure transparency with those races. And I think that campaign finance reform is going to move a lot like issues like marriage equality, where it wasn't a top-down approach, it was a bottom-up approach, where we saw one municipality after another municipality coming up with resolutions and declarations that they were going to, you know, make themselves, you know, declare that they're in support of this issue and just let the brush fire catch fire that way and move from the bottom up instead of from the top down.
Right. You've been mentioning Citizens United, which was a U.S. Supreme Court decision made in 2010. And I'm also wondering, there's another Wisconsin connection to campaign finance reform that is debated whether it was very effective or not, was the McCain-Feingold campaign reform law. Do you think that the change really is needing to be bottom up despite having federal offices dedicated to changing campaign finance reform?
You know, I think we need both. But I think that the urgency that is required because of, I mean, look at the news that just broke a couple of days ago. It all goes back to campaign finance. It all goes back to following the money that's moving into political campaigns. And the news that broke with Michael Cohen and President Trump isn't even starting to touch on the fact that we well may have had foreign money pouring into our presidential campaigns as well. So, yes, we absolutely need enforcement at the federal level. I think that reformers need to keep pushing for that. But I also want to give folks a sense of hope that you can actually have really significant effects at the state and local level, too, because the reality is that with the Supreme Court in place that we have right now, which is essentially the same Supreme Court that voted for Citizens United, that's probably not going to go anywhere anytime quick. So the best way to show that pressure to our elected officials in Washington, D.C., and frankly to the Supreme Court, is to show that the average everyday voter is just demanding that we get our elections back in order, that we know where the money is coming from that's trying to influence this massive amount of political power that we have in American elections.
During a testimony during Dark Money in Montana, one of the lawyers stated, you know, quote, "Do we care enough and are we brave enough?" How do you think this issue of dark money and campaign finance reform can be addressed effectively when, you know, it takes perhaps a national story such as President Trump's former lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen to plead guilty to things like tax evasion, falsifying submissions to a bank, and campaign finance violations? You know, do you think that there needs to be top stories to kind of get the public's attention and keep it on campaign finance reform?
I think those federal stories help. to draw attention to the how important these campaign finance issues are. There's also a big story that's developing right now about Russian money moving into the NRA's 501c4 group and the extent to which that was influencing elections as well. That's something that I'm keeping my eye on. And, of course, that's what we detail in our film, is how this whole strategy, how this shell game was working in Montana. We were able to really connect all of the dots and show people how this scheme works and what to keep an eye out for. Also, kind of parenthetically, I should also note that there's a chapter about Wisconsin that we have in our film, and I'm afraid it serves as essentially a cautionary tale of what happens when you have dark money that takes root in one wing of government and how that can be really pernicious when it takes over each branch of government and none of the branches are keeping an eye out on the other branches where there's no enforcement whatsoever. That very quickly can allow an entire state's government to slip into the hands of just a moneyed few who are using dark money as their tactic. That's a really cautionary tale. So, you know, as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, that's really the role of this film is to show how this scheme works so that we can call people's attention to it and show them how these dots are really connected. Because I think that the average voter is pretty skeptical and fairly suspicious and understands that there's a lot of money in politics. There's a lot of money in anonymous money in politics, and that leads to pretty rampant corruption. And people are, I think, pretty fed up. I mean, if you look at all of the major candidates that were running for office at the presidential level in 2016, they were all, you know, saying pretty much the same thing, that, you know, this system is broken, there's way too much money, it leads to corruption, we need to call it whatever you want, drain the swamp, right? Everybody was kind of pushing that same button, because there's one thing that is clear is that across the political aisle, across the political spectrum, that people are really fed up with the way that we're running our elections and with the influence of money in politics. This is really a bipartisan issue. So what does that mean in, you know, spots like Milwaukee, where our elected officials are pretty much, I think there's a tendency to skew to the left side of the aisle, is like we just have to make sure that we hold those elected officials accountable once they get into office so that we can actually do something about campaign finance reform instead of just talking about it.
Well, Kimberly Reed, sure. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today about your documentary, Dark Money.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kimberly Reed is director and producer of the new documentary, Dark Money. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski. The film opens in Milwaukee at the Oriental Theater today, and you can find out more at WUWN.com.
We'll take a quick break now, and then Milwaukee Opera Theater returns with another delightful mashup of pop culture, comic books, and, well, opera. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. If you have ever seen a Milwaukee Opera Theater production, you already know they don't present your normal operatic fare. If you've never seen a Milwaukee Opera Theater production, well...
From the Mikado, performed with toy pianos and handmade percussion, to a mashup of opera and heavy metal called Guns N' Roses Cavalier, a performance by M.O.T. is sure to shake out any assumptions about opera that you might have.
Tonight's opening of Doc Danger and the Danger Squad is no exception. This musical, written for the company by Jason Powell, is another mashup of Pulp Fiction characters with lovely melodies and a completely realistic storyline about saving the universe. Powell, along with M.O.T.'s artistic director Jill Ann Aponisic and actor Harper Navin, join me in the studio now. Welcome all of you. It is so nice to have you here on Lake Effect, Jill Ann. Anna,
it's
Jason,
so nice to be here.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bonnie.
So, Doc Danger.
Right? This Doc Danger has a danger squad. It's a new musical by Jason Powell, who wrote Fortuna the Time Bender versus the Schoolgirls of Doom for
I
us.
I sense a theme, Jason.
Perhaps.
Well, yeah.
Just a little.
I seem to keep coming back to it for some reason, even if I say that I don't want to write about superheroes anymore. I end up doing it anyway. So I guess
you're wearing the proper T-shirt as well today.
Yeah.
No, this is radio and no one can see this, but you are wearing a Superman T-shirt.
Yeah, I know no one could see it, but I figured it would help me get in the proper spirit for the interview.
He can't help himself.
No, yeah. Obviously not.
It's in the blood.
Yep. And it's possible that neither can we. Fortuna was the first full-length piece that we commissioned at MOT, and ever since then, I think Jason and I had been talking about what might come next. And Doc Danger is really sort of spiritually similar, but its own piece. It's not a sequel. It doesn't feature the same characters. It's based, rather than a mashup of comic books and Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, which is what Fortuna was, Doc Danger takes as its inspiration the pulp fiction from the early 20th century and has a more expansive, unruly plot and more characters and more heroes and more villains and sort of more of everything.
Yeah. It's
I'm looking at Jason like, why did you do that to me?
Yeah. Yeah. Sequelitis. You always have to have more villains
yes,
and
something,
more heroes.
Something bigger, something yeah. better. Yeah. Yeah. And so, Joanna, this is also, not only is it bigger and better for this piece, but this is MOT's, well, your 10th anniversary with MOT.
It is. I can't believe it. It's only the second day of my 10th season, and I'm exhausted.
Yeah. So. And so this is a really cool way to kind of kick off that.
Yeah, it felt like
season.
Just the right sort of celebration. A local piece with a local cast and a local venue expresses Milwaukee Opera Theater's commitment to Milwaukee and the artists who live and work here.
So introduce me to the artist who is sitting to your right.
Speaking of Milwaukee artists,
yes.
This is Harper Navin,
hi.
Our youngest cast member who is playing the role of the kid.
Okay. So, Harper, how did you find out about all of this?
Well, I have, my mom has known Jason for a while now, and she got a call one day from Joanna asking if I could perform as the role of Kid, and I was ecstatic because I had never worked for Milwaukee Opera Theater before, and just super excited.
So where had you worked before?
I've worked at places around Milwaukee, like First Stage and Skylight Music Theater, and Sunset Playhouse in Elm Grove.
So you had actually seen her on stage before.
I had, yeah. And I think we actually called and asked, is it okay if we write a role for Harper?
Oh.
So, like, from the very beginning.
I did not know that.
You were I'm happy to spring that on you now.
Oh.
It was, yeah, part from, like, the inception of the piece, this thought about developing a role for her.
That's very cool.
It's exciting.
People usually wait much longer in their careers to get roles
oh, yeah.
for them. You know, they're usually much older, you know,
right.
before that happens.
But so. I'm right, Jason, aren't I? Yeah. Since
yeah.
I just said it on the radio. Just say that I'm right.
Now it has to be true. It's on the radio.
It is. There's no fake news here.
That's right.
Yeah. It's all real. It's all real. No, that's fantastic. And so what is it like working with these folks?
Oh, it's so cool. It's so interesting working next to such esteemed people in the Milwaukee theater area. It's so cool to draw inspiration from people that have been working in theater their whole entire lives. It's inspirational to see the kind of work that these people do every day in rehearsal and outside of rehearsal, too. It's super interesting.
What have you learned so far?
Mm. Ooh, I've learned a lot about, like, character building and, like, just by watching the other actors, really, especially since the characters in this show are so diverse and, like, there's cowboys, there's villains, there's evil masterminds, there's everything. And it's so cool to see everyone completely embody their characters. And I've learned a lot about how the littlest movement can really help your acting, and I think it's really interesting.
I think it is, too.
That makes sense. We're in a really small space. We're in the studio theater at the right. Broadway Theater Center, so the little 99-seat black box. So a lot of the work that we do in rehearsal is about, like, how can the tiniest gesture or the smallest vocal inflection communicate something specific to the audience? So that's, I think, what you're mm-hmm. picking up on.
Yeah.
And I think we're learning from Harper, too, in that she's so, like, immediate and ready and open at every minute of rehearsal to just, like, take a new idea and go. There's this really beautiful, like, quick quickness about Harper and the way that she works in rehearsal.
Thank you.
And in that space, anyone who has seen anything in that space, you know, you can see everything.
Oh, yeah.
So you need to be 100% invested in whatever you're doing, because the audience is going to know if you're not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't hide behind distance or something else. You know, you're right there.
And we somehow have to find a way to take these kind of gigantic super characters and knit them together in that space in a way that makes sense for this production, which I think is our artistic adventure as we move toward the opening night.
One of the things that I've always loved since we met 10 years ago from your first season, I know it's hard to believe it's been 10 years, is the kind of experimentation, the kind of willingness to take on new work, the willingness to, you know, take risks with brand new, never before, you know, that kind of thing, and putting it out there and doing it well enough that you're here 10 years later.
The well enough is a really important qualifier.
Yes. That's the thing. A lot of people want to do that, but they don't do it well enough to continue to do it.
Oh, thank you. That's a beautiful thing to say.
Yeah. And so it's, and I don't mean well enough as a dig at all. It's that no production is ever perfect. So it's like, how well can you do it in order to make people keep wanting to come back and see what you're going to do next?
I think that if I look back, we try and choose our risks with great care and then really hurl ourselves toward them. So it's in selecting the risk that you're taking with a particular production and knowing that you don't know how that will turn out. And so you are genuinely risking failure. But you know that these other variables, these other aspects of the production are rock solid, so that at the very least you have that core intact. And those variables can shift from piece to piece. But like, we know that with Doc Danger, we have Jason's exquisite wordplay and hooky musical language. And we know that we have this incredibly talented cast. And we know we have an infectious story and vibrant, joyful energy.
So what's the risk?
That it won't synthesize. You know, I think that, and when something becomes a little bit of a culty, heartwarming piece the way Fortuna did for so many people, that anything that gets compared to it will somehow lack that warmth or that innovation. You know, I think that's actually the scary part about trying to retrace any of your steps, is that they'll be compared to something earlier. Like, sometimes you just want to venture into the wilderness and have no
connections back at all.
Yeah.
No breadcrumbs.
Like, right. There's nothing to compare this to. It's its own wacko piece. So
We're
all on our own. But in this case, we're kind of building a repertoire. So that has its own terror.
Well, and that's the thing that happens with companies, is that you build on past successes and learn from any past failures you might have. And then all of a sudden, you've got a point of view.
Totally describes MOT over the last 10 years. I don't think we knew what we were headed toward. We just knew why we were making the decisions we were making. And then it's only after 10 years and 30-some productions that you can look back and go, oh, a style emerged, you know, or a specific point of view started to express itself. I think with Doc Danger, it's going to be, we have a brand new cast. That's part of the energy and risk, is that we do not have our veteran actors in this one, or people who have come to be identified with Milwaukee Opera Theater. We really have opened this up to a new generation of performers. So we have a younger, newer cast in this one, and it's bigger, and we have more stories overlapping. So it's more, it expresses the Pulp Fiction anthology idea by actually having this series of supervillains and their superheroes all entangled in the same Save the Universe situation. As opposed to one hero and one villain.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Multiple lines, multiple stories happening.
Yes. Yeah. And they have to, they're each in their own independent stories, and then they have to collide in the middle and unite to
Save the world.
Yes.
Or the universe.
Or the galaxy.
Or something.
Or everything as we know it.
Everything as we know it, yes. So, Harper, how does it feel to be part of the new cast, the younger, newer, brighter.
I think it's so fun. Everyone is super nice. It's really just exciting to work with all these people that I haven't worked with before. It's interesting, again, to draw off of their ideas. It's fun to see how the show is developing with the younger, newer cast, because it's just whole different point of views. And the way that Jelena directs, it lets everyone bring their own style into the piece. So it's not just like one person deciding everything. It's a collision of everyone's ideas to make this piece something new and special that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, it's a collision, all right.
Collision is an excellent word there. And so, Jason, once you heard Harper sing some of the work that you made for her, what did you think?
I was delighted.
Were you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it everything you heard in your head?
Yeah. You know, it's that weird sort of combination of writing for specific voices, but part of the reason you do that is because you know you're writing for people who will surprise you.
Right.
So, you know, it's you expect it to be good, but you don't expect the specifics, I guess. You know what I mean? So, like Harper said, everyone in the show has their own, or both of you said it, I guess, that kind of every single actor in the show has their own very distinct style, I think, and just individual energy that when you see it all together, it's, I think it's a great example for me of what I like about theater, that collaborative energy, you know, that you don't get the same thing when you're just seeing one person perform that you do when you see. It's not the same thing. You know, it's you're seeing however many people we have, 8 or 9 or 10 or 11. Is it 11?
It's 11, people? Yeah.
11. You're not seeing 11 individual performances, even though they're 11 individual styles. You're seeing the sort of rainbow that, you know, comes together when they're all together.
That greater than the sum of its parts.
I was going to say, like, as I'm listening, I think I'm hearing you describe something that I sometimes talk about as being like there's half an idea, or like you bring the map of what we're doing to us, but then we have to interpret that map, and it's the space between those things that gets really exciting. You know, just in terms of you can have an idea in your mind about what you're writing and what you think it's going to be, but it's where it meets that other person's imagination. And then what those two things, whether Jason's in the room with us or not, like he's left us this information that is him, right? It sort of represents him in the room, even if he's not there in person. And we're working with him when he's not there. And it's that it's that space where the two ideas meet that gets exciting. And then that's what you're describing, too, in terms of the rehearsal hall, is like we all pour our 12 imaginations into the middle of the room and start working together to build something. Like you have the relationships between everybody's ideas, like starting to create a structure.
Right. And that's why it would change if the cast changes.
Absolutely.
Because it's a whole nother, even with the same material.
Absolutely.
It's what makes theater fresh, I think, and why we can keep revisiting pieces that are 150 years old or whatever, and, you know, and then have room for new.
Yeah, it's a different way of building it, too, where you're not thinking about something like a Lego piece that gets switched out, or this is how it's done, so if someone else steps in, you need to do it exactly as the originator did it, which is sort of the commercial model, right? Like, you keep the product intact, no matter who's switching in to play that role. But this is a very different, like, oh, depending on the cast, it's going to be a completely different production, because they are expected to, like, bring themselves to it.
Exactly. And that's the thing, is you bring yourself to it, which is what I think makes all of the Milwaukee Opera Theater, you know, performances so exciting to witness, because you require that of your actors
and
singers.
A little mean sometimes, yeah.
Well, I am so looking forward to this. It's going to be...
Who knows what it'll be like?
Who knows what it'll
be? We actually don't know.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out by opening night. And you've got a couple of weeks, right?
Yes.
In there. So, and it's at the Studio Theater.
Yes. We close August 30th so that Harley Davidson can take over the Broadway. I think they're closing down the whole street for their
motorcycle
festival. Yeah.
So good thing we saved the universe before.
So
that
we're gonna
happens.
Do it. Yeah, we're gonna get that done right before.
Yeah, because
they take over.
You know, they couldn't take over if you hadn't saved the universe.
Right. So they should be grateful.
They should. Yeah. They should. I hope they all come.
I do too.
Anyway, I want to thank all three of you for coming in today. Thank you so much for everything, and we will talk again.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thanks.
Jill Anaponicek is Artistic Director of Milwaukee Opera Theater. Jason Powell wrote the company's newest musical, Doc Danger and the Danger Squad. Harper Navin plays the kid.
The show opens tonight in the Studio Theater at the Broadway Theater Center in the Third Ward. You can find more info at WUWM.com.
Another break, and then we'll listen back to a conversation with Wauwatosa writer Tom Matthews about his novel, Raising the Dad. It came out this spring. Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Wauwatosa writer Tom Matthews is well known in the area in large measure because of his rock music writing. But he's also a novelist, and while his knowledge of the Midwestern rock scene informs some of his latest novel, the subject matter goes far beyond music.
Raising the Dad explores complex family relationships, end-of-life care, and plenty of existential issues in a plot that is at turns dark, funny, and affecting. Tom Matthews joined us in the spring as the novel was coming out. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
Well, and so how do we feel about spoilers? We can talk about the basic premise here, right?
Right, yeah.
So there's a big development that happens. It's probably about 40 pages into this book, and I don't think we can talk about it without explaining what's going on. So
right.
John Husted is your hero.
Mm-hmm.
Husted.
Yeah.
He is living what sounds like a pretty standard, if unexciting, middle-age experience in a southern Wisconsin city. What else should we know about John as the book opens?
Well, let me back up a little bit, because this is sort of rooted very loosely in my story. My father was a doctor down in Beloit, where I was born. He died of a heart attack when I was 10, which was traumatic in all the ways you'd imagine. Jump forward about 15 years, and I have this dream. And in the dream, a doctor friend of my father's comes to me, and gravely tells me he has to tell me something. He takes me into this very sparse room, and there is my father, silent and stilled by a devastating system failure, beyond any kind of communication or engagement, but he's alive. And I found that enormously profound. It just really affected me. Just to be in the same room with him and touch his warm skin and know you're breathing the same air, it really, really, in a way no other dream ever has, really stuck with me.
Things diverge a little bit in the book, though, because
yes.
John is somewhat further along in life, a little further along when his father dies, but much further along when this, you know, shocking truth
right.
comes to him.
Right. Jump forward another 20 years. I'm starting a graduate writing program at Mary. I just need something to write in the story. So I remember this dream. I tried a short story. It goes well. It strikes a really nice balance between really deep emotion but also unexpected sort of mordant humor. My next semester is a novel writing class. I don't think I can sustain this really wildly seemingly implausible premise across a book, but I figure I'll take a shot. That also feels good. It becomes my thesis project. It's a book. But that is the premise. This man who has a fairly typical dysfunctional family life suddenly, remarkably, is made aware of the fact that the father they all thought had been dead for decades is alive in this silent state. He has to decide if they can even know about what he knows and maintain the family. So that is his burden.
You say the family is on the verge of collapse. His mom is dealing with the onset of dementia. He has a teenage daughter who is turning into a teenage daughter. He has a brother who's just gotten out of jail. And he has a marriage that it sounds like, just from your portrayal, is not catastrophically horrible, but, you know, the kind of death by a thousand paper cuts model.
It's going cold. So there's just a lot of relationships that are not uncommon, but all things that he has to take into account as he has to move forward with this surprise that's been given to him.
Speaking as someone who every once in a while has some strange dreams, a lot has to happen to give them any kind of narrative arc. Can you talk about this process, you know, of turning it into first a short story and then a novel, you know, going from this single idea to wading in through the kind of complex social issues that are also touched on by this situation?
Yeah, the dream touched me because I think I had, and I think probably still do, a fairly pragmatic view of a life that has fallen into this condition. I think it's time to let them go. They're not serving a purpose, so to speak, but I realized in the dream there was something profound there, and it really sort of, I say sometimes it sort of makes an end-of-life statement I'm not sure I agree with, but I think that's what makes it interesting. And I also think, without giving anything away, by the end of the book, the father has kind of healed this family without ever doing anything. Just his presence helps. So that was kind of the thing pulling me forward. And it also was just this very bizarre circumstance of this guy. He's also my research told me it's not that amazing that you could sustain a life that long if you just commit to this very relentless care. You know, Terry Schiavo lived for 15 years and could still be alive if they hadn't been all that court stuff. So I had to do a lot of work to sort of sell the premise. But the fact is, it just falls on John's head to sustain his father's care going forward, financially, emotionally. There's a spot where the father is, which almost becomes another character in the story. And also, what I really liked about it is John, just by necessity, spends a lot of time in solitude at his father's bedside and starts mulling over his life with his father, who he doesn't really remember.
He's stunned to find out that his father was really kind of a funny guy.
Yeah, yeah. The father was, a very successful doctor, but way too committed to his job. He wasn't close to his son.
How much of that is pulled from your own experience?
My father was kind of a mover and shaker in the hospital scene in Beloit, and he was working a lot. And when he was home, he was in his den working some more. And I wish I had more memory of him. But he also, like my father, who I can still go down to Beloit and meet people who were his patients or work for him, and he's just revered down there. But there's part of me saying, am I getting the whole story? I would love to really learn more about my father and maybe even learn some things that aren't so flattering. And John, again, just because he has all this time on his hands, starts learning about his father and learns something about him that is troubling, but it humanizes his father in a way that would never have happened if this hadn't all been given to him.
One of the things that hit me as I was reading this and kind of considering the implications of what John is going through in the story is a lot of us think of these end-of-life issues, the Terry Schiavo case, for example, a very, very famous example, as really ethical and political sorts of issues. And at the same time, for the people who are most connected to them, John in this case, he has to think about it in those terms, but he also has to consider it in very personal, very emotional terms.
Yeah, yeah. Part of it is financial. The only other person who knows is his wife, who is kind of a voice of she provides the straight talk when John won't really confront some of the things he has to confront. But financially, this is a burden. In terms of his career, it's a burden. He starts screwing up with his job because of this. Again, it's just a relentless care that this his father needs. And it's also just, how can you not bring this news to your mother and your brother? But briefly, the mother, because of her dementia, quite possibly could not emotionally handle the news. And John's brother is this very sketchy person.
Let's talk about John's brother here, because we've had you on the show any number of times in your work as a rock writer, and so there's a lot of the heavy metal scene in northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin from about the last 30 years that makes its way into this. That had to be a little bit enjoyable to write.
Well, I knew Mike, the brother, is a very unpleasant person, and I knew that I needed, not just for my reader, but for me. I just had to find something, not that I liked about him, but at least was interesting. I am a ravenous reader of rock and roll memoirs, the shabbier the better. So I was reading, it was either Slash of Guns N' Roses or Nikki Sixx of Motley Crue.
Famed authors that both of them are.
Yes, men of letters, at least tattoos.
Yeah.
But I was reading one of those and said, that's it. Mike was an aspiring heavy metal singer. Actually, for the craft he was pursuing, was very, very good at it, but he also got drawn into the lifestyle. And having signed a major label contract, his life immediately blew up. And that's his backstory, is he had a taste of the fame, and now he's just a sad figure who John worries that Mike would recognize that having the father back is really just something to exploit for a lawsuit. Mike would not, because Mike and the father hated each other up until the time the father died, quote unquote. And that's the other dilemma, that John doesn't know if he can trust his brother to be as moved by this as he is. So there are two very credible reasons for maybe John should just let this end and never tell them. But that's just, how do you do that? So, yeah, it's complicated.
Well, Tom Matthews, I think we can all be grateful. It's great stuff. Thank you so much. And again, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Tom Matthews is a writer who lives in Wauwatosa. His latest novel is called Raising the Dead, and our interview with him first aired this spring.
Bubbler Talk takes on the past, present, and hazy future of a former Milwaukee shopping landmark. That's when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Chuck Kornbach answering this question. What is Milwaukee planning to revitalize the Northridge area? Northridge was one of several large local malls built in the 1960s and 70s. It was at the far northwestern edge of Milwaukee at 76th Street and Brown Deer Road. Northridge closed 15 years ago, but plenty of people have mall memories. Milwaukee alderwoman Shantia Lewis remembers that as a teenager, it was a good place to be.
Of course I go back to Northridge, back in the glory days. My friend worked at the Marcus Theater that was inside. I remember being behind the scenes and being in the projection room and really just like hanging out.
But the glory didn't last. Lewis says one of the reasons for Northridge's decline may have been shoppers incorrectly fearing crime in the area. She says it didn't help that in 1992, a white man, Jesse Anderson, falsely blamed two African-American youth for the killing of his wife outside Northridge. In a WUWM story for NPR, then-Alderman Marvin Pratt criticized police and the media for initially accepting Anderson's claim.
Black youth and black young men are blamed for everything from epidemics to earthquakes.
Anderson was eventually convicted of committing the murder. He later died in a state prison in the same inmate attack that killed mass murderer Jeffrey Dahmer. Meanwhile, the Northridge site has gone into extended limbo. Most of the buildings are still there, but empty, a big-box ghost town with a chain-link fence around it. Elsewhere on the former Northridge property, a few businesses opened several years ago, though some have since closed. The Menards Building Supply Store at the south end is apparently doing well and may expand. In the Menards parking lot, shopper Steve Mashevsky said he never had a bad time at Northridge and said new life isn't out of the question.
Well, anything can be reimagined or reopened in some way, you know. It's just who wants to invest there.
For a while, Penzi's Spices planned to open a company headquarters and warehouse on about 150,000 square feet, or about a third of the massive Northridge property. But last year, owner William Penzi gave that land to the city of Milwaukee. Sam Leichtling of the Department of City Development says officials are now looking at a potential mix of light industrial buildings, office space, and retail along 76th Street. He says local people want jobs.
And that's the thing we heard consistently from residents is we want places on the Northwest Side that hire people who are living on the Northwest Side and you don't have to drive to a surrounding community.
Carolyn Eswine is a UW-Milwaukee professor of urban planning who's been helping chart a new course for Northridge. She says green space may be needed, too, to help break up the acres of old parking lots.
Where if I live south of Brown Deer up on the hill, I could come down and walk on weekends, or I might use a trail system. So there's a public space element that comes along with this that employees can use during the week, during the day, residents can use as well.
But City of Milwaukee officials say much remains on hold due to the Chinese couple that owns the rest of the former mall property. A few years ago, the couple's firm, Black Spruce Enterprise Group, announced plans to convert that part of Northridge into a trade mart for Asian businesses. Those plans have stalled, though the city says the firm is paying property taxes. Black Spruce did not respond to our email requesting comment. Alderwoman Lewis, the former mall shopper who now represents the Northridge area, has a message for the Chinese owners.
So I've said to them and to their liaison on several occasions, I need movement on this property or you're not going to like me very much.
Lewis says the city is exploring its legal options and will do what it has to do to produce a long-term solution. More immediately, Lewis is encouraging people to come to a festival next weekend in part of the Northridge parking lot. The event is also being advertised on radio.
Milwaukee, get ready. Labor Day weekend.
For the 2018 Notes, Jokes, and Hope Musical Festival.
Going down. Alderwoman Lewis says the hope part of the event will aim to show positive things can happen again at the old Northridge site. Chuck Quernbach, 89.7 WUWM.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski and Joy Powers, and we get production assistance from Maddie Andre. And this week, we have to say goodbye to a spectacular crop of summer interns, Ben Binversi, Lauren Keene, and Gabby Powell.
Thanks to all of you for your great work and best of luck. Thanks also to the rest of our team, especially specialty reporters Susan Bentz, Chuck Quernbach, Taryn Powell, and Emily Files, plus digital producer Lauren Sigvason.
Jason Reavy is our studio engineer and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's here on Listener Supported, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.